Hello, fellow writers. We have an interview for you with Sonali Dev, whose Bollywood romances have always reflected her love of all things Jane Austen, and whose latest books are all in on that passion. If you're all in with books, reading, and writing, you might want to check out the latest book from Jenny Nash at our sponsor, Author Accelerator. Read books all day and get paid for it, the business of book coaching. You can find that and more at authoraccelerator.com.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now one, two, three.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, fiction, nonfiction, short pieces, long pieces, proposals, pitches. You are allowed to start to write things that do not start with P, although I may not list them here. And in short, we are the podcast about sitting down and getting your work done.
I'm Serena Bowen. I am trying to get the work done this week on romance novel number 36, and you can find more about me at serenabowen.com.
And I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the novel Chickens, the Chicken Sisters, and you heard it here first. I don't know when it's coming out. We've just delayed that puppy from this summer unto the future. Not the indefinite future, but I don't know what kind of future. So, everybody's talking me off the ledge because I'm not super happy about it, but it is what it is. And when it comes out, it's going to be great. It really is. It really is. Okay, deep breaths. I'm also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, which did come out in paperback this summer. I'm a former editor of the Motherlode blog at the New York Times and still sometimes a contributor there. And you'll find me bookstagramming on Instagram at KJDA. And we have a guest today that I am really excited about. So, I hate reading everybody the canned intro to the authors all the time where I like sort of just suck pieces off of their websites. So I'm sorry, guest Sonali Dev, I'm revealing your identity, which is in the title anyway. I'm just going to riff because I am a fan and I feel like I know all the things without having to write them down. So Sonali Dev is our guest today. She is the author of four straight up Bollywood style romances, but her last book but one, before this one, was a take on Pride and Prejudice. And this one, the current book, which is called Recipe for Persuasion, is, you're going to guess, an adaptation. I don't even know what the word for it is, but you know, it follows the arc of the Jane Austen book Persuasion, and we're going to talk about that and all kinds of things. And Sonali, I'm so excited that you're here.
Thank you so much for having me. And I think what I like to call it is an homage to not even
That's
an
good.
Homage to the novel, but an homage to what I learned personally from the novel as a young girl growing up. So it's inspired by and it's an homage to her work.
That completely works. And I think I have not yet finished Persuasion, although I am deep, deep, deep into it. And I absolutely gobbled Pride, Prejudice, and other flavors. And I think, yeah, you're not someone that sticks tightly to what's been done before in any way. And that's what makes them so good.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, that's not even my intent ever. You know, these are completely my stories. There's no doubt. And like I said, what they are to me is not even really so much about the story, but what I learned from that story and what it made me and what it makes me want to say. And so they're mm-hmm. absolutely mm-hmm. my stories. But, you know, but it very much is, you know, is paying homage to her original stories.
And how did you decide to do that? Like, it's a big, difficult task, right? To nod at this work that you already love so much. So what was the deciding factor for you that this would be your next big series of projects?
So it's really strange because, you know how we have those childhood dreams that we kind of, you know, that are grand, like the Oscar speeches we give in front of mirrors and things like that, you know, where you dream you're going to do something. And Jane Austen was one of my earliest favorites. She was, I think, a very strong influence on me as a young girl, because what I saw in her books was, you know, aligned very closely with who I was on the inside, but what was not being reinforced by the stories in my world. I grew up in India, and the stories we were hearing rarely were about women wanting things and getting them. And so that in Jane Austen's work spoke to me, because, you know, her heroines at a time when there was nothing in their world telling them they were worthy of anything, considered themselves worthy of getting love, and they didn't end up either crazy or dead like all the other classics. So from a very early age, and I also dreamed of being a big fancy, in quotation marks, a big fancy author sitting in my big fancy cottage by the beach and writing. You know, that was my faraway dream as a little girl. And so very early, like, I couldn't even tell you where the genesis of that idea was, but very early I knew I wanted to tell her stories, you know, my way. And then as I, you know, as I started to take the publishing journey seriously, and I became a published author, it was always very front and center in my mind. And as that idea had, you know, had taken shape and become real, I knew that I wanted to take these four novels, which are my favorite four novels, and tell them under one story umbrella. And I also wanted them to be entirely my stories while still being very much nods to her. And so all of that was just always in my head. And I think in 2013, I sold my first book and had my first agent. And at the time, you know, we had sold the first two Bollywood books, and you know how agents and authors who want a career kind of want to stay a few steps ahead. And when we were having that conversation, I told her about this idea, and she, you know, was her reaction in a very casually dismissive way was that Austen doesn't sell, so we're not going to do that. And even for a second, that didn't dissuade me, which kind of tells you how much a part of me this was. So, you know, it was always something I was going to do, no matter what anybody else, you know, who else was on that train or not. So it was just somehow, and I think that has to do with how much of an influence she was for me as a woman and as a person growing up. So I always knew I was going to do this.
Wow.
If we read your first four books really carefully, knowing this now, would we see hints? I think you see hints of Darcy, for example, in something that I'm writing now. And I'm aware of it. And it's not an homage. It's not anything. It's just some of the ways that he interacted with Elizabeth are reflected in what I'm working in. So would we find them? Would we find little clues?
I think you would be hard pressed not to find some influence of her, you know, in any romance novel. So,
yeah, you're probably right.
So definitely, you would, in fact, I think when I was selling Bollywood Bride, my hook was, of all things, Wuthering Heights meets Monsoon Wedding, you know? And so I think the things that we read as children are, you know, obviously in. And then the other day I was talking to someone and they said, you know, when this person read Bollywood Bride, they got a Jane Eyre sense. And I think that has to do with the fact that there is a crazy lady in the attic. But
yeah,
you know,
that'll do it.
But
hard to write a crazy lady in the attic without evoking a little Jane Eyre.
There's just no way. So, you know, like, you can't write a bad, arrogant bad proposal without invoking Jane Austen. There's just no way to do it. You can't write an arrogant man without invoking Darcy. And so, I, you know, for sure, I think you see, you know, you see that in those books. I think how you see it more is in the voice, and in there's a little bit of cynicism, in all my writing, I think, and this, you know, this need to laugh at the world we live in was something I think, again, was reinforced by Jane Austen and by P.G. Wodehouse, and, you know, those authors that I read as a child. Like, we live in this world and it's flippin' ridiculous, and that it's okay to live in it and yet find it completely ridiculous was something, again, that felt okay because I read these books young. And I think that is certainly, you know, if you looked, you would find in a lot of the inner dialogue and the narrative of all of my books is, you know, the fact that all is not well with our world and it's kind of ridiculous.
Can I ask a question about, you just made such a terrific case for the fun and the backbone that you get by writing an homage to something you love. And I just want to think about the risks for a second, because that's something we do on the podcast a lot, is just to think about the pros and cons of various paths. So I read a book a few years ago called The Flight of Gemma Hardy, a novel by Margaret Livesey. And it's a Jane Eyre take, which is super fun. And I went to see this author at my local bookstore, and she started to talk about why she wrote this book. And my jaw kind of hit the floor, because she had a life that began a little bit like a Jane Eyre. So she was just primed to write this thing. But so I took this wonderful book home and I read it and I enjoyed every minute of it. But in the back of my head, I was always like, what is she going to do with the crazy woman in the attic? Like, so to me, that announced itself as a risk, like that readers would be looking for certain plot cues to happen. So how do you subvert that?
You know, so what you're saying is that if you pick up a book that is titled Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, you're going to be looking for
Lydia.
You're looking for a story that's kicked off by a misunderstanding and egos being hurt. You're looking for the bad proposal. You're looking, you know, so again, I think what, and this happened fairly naturally, and this might just be a nature and personality thing, is that I really only cared for what I wanted to say, and I really only cared for the story I wanted to tell. And so if at any point I had thought, I never, you know, for a moment, and this is with all my books, I rarely think about what it is people want to hear. I feel like I'm doing a disservice to writing. It's and not to sound, you know, obnoxious, but I feel like this in the way I live and in everything. If you say things that you think people want to hear, then you have zero credibility, and there's really no authenticity in living like that. And so I try to kind of transfer that to how I write. And so so just naturally, I don't worry about it. And that explains a lot possibly about my career. And
so you're just kind of like, well, the Lydia is coming, or, and that's okay. Like, I know that if people maybe know that the Lydia is coming, I'm just using Lydia because that's a pretty easy one. But I'm good with that. Like, I'm rolling along, and by God, the Lydia train is about to crash into my story.
No, not even that. I'm thinking if Lydia is not important to the story I'm telling, then she doesn't have to be there. Then she doesn't have to be there. Like, I want this story to be about two people who start off on the wrong foot because of how they see the world and themselves. And that's what I want. Only in that much is what I want to do with Pride and Prejudice. You know, I want to only explore or I want to explore how, you know, how when you meet someone who is completely different from you, you know, what that does to your own, you know, how you process yourself and the world, right? And so that is what I want to do. And so that's what I'm going to do. I'm not thinking about people looking for for Wickham or for Lydia or any of that. So if, you know, it's only in that much, that I want mm-hmm. to retell that story. Now, if that kickoff point where there is the misunderstanding comes naturally to my story, and if that proposal comes naturally to my story, only then it has a place in my book.
Right.
So like with Persuasion, at least with Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, there are some plotish, consistencies. But with Persuasion, you'd be hard-pressed to find anything more than a thematic connection.
Oh, I'm interested in this because I've totally been sitting here going, where is the... So Persuasion is my least favorite Jane Austen book, and I want to get to that. But
I want to talk about that because I've been hearing so many people say,
okay, we're totally talking to that. But I'm watching for who the other girl is, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she's not even coming. So, but don't tell me. We're not spoilering
Louisa Musgrove.
So that's kind of fun.
So I will say,
I had guessed. I was like, oh, I'll bet this is the girl who falls off the wall. I forget her name. I can remember the first
Louisa
line.
Musgrave.
Yes, Louisa Musgrave. Thank you.
So I think that for me, again, the way I think about the story is that Louisa Musgrove isn't Louisa Musgrove in the story. She is, she is the thing or the device that keeps Anne and Wentworth's misunderstandings reinforced. So what she is mm-hmm. is them not growing enough to put their past behind them. So what you will find is other things that keep them from doing that. You will not find, and you might be able to take a character and say, okay, she's kind of Louisa Musgrove, but what she really is just that, that thing standing in their way, which is really, in terms of story, to me, mm-hmm. What I'm trying to get them over.
Right. Well, you need that, because otherwise it's boring.
And that's the story. The story is about getting over mistakes, but not by magic, but by growing. So, so that's the story I'm trying to tell. The story that no mistake is absolute. I'm not trying to tell, the story of Captain Wentworth per se. I'm trying to tell the story of this, this warrior-like man who goes off and makes lemonade when life gives him lemons, but has not let go of his past, and how, how he's going to process a second chance, and this girl who, who has to grow a spine, and, was never spineless.
That's why Persuasion is my least favorite Jane Austen, because I have trouble with the spineless heroine, but... Yours, I can tell, has a spine. It's just, like, she's just, I don't know, put it in a closet somewhere.
Again, with both of them. Now, I don't see Anne as spineless. I see Anne as very much a product of her time. But if she were truly spineless, she would have just gone off and married the next Joe who comes along. So Anne is just someone who feels differently from how the world around her feels. And she has to... make that journey of being okay with it. I think this is a very universal journey, and we all make it. It's just less overt in our day to day, because the world will tell us being X is really what makes you cool, or all of that. And if you naturally don't feel X, then you have to make the journey of that being okay. And I think that's her journey. So it's not spinelessness. She never is okay with what doesn't feel okay to her. She just has to find a way to find that power to let that become.
That's probably why Persuasion does work, even though, like you said, you're hearing a lot of people say that they have frustration with the heroine. There's a lot of pleasure in seeing her find her way to be okay with it. And also, I think you're right, we all know that we're in that it's a really common journey. Maybe it's just one we don't like to think that hard about.
Yeah, and we don't live in a world with overt taboos or overt divisions in society, but they're all still there. It's just become more silent, and it's become less easy to find. But I feel we still relate to those journeys because it's very much there and it's our daily struggle. I don't think there is a person in the world who feels completely comfortable in their skin from the day that they were born. And so, you know, so which is why this this whole woman against her world or woman against expectation story works for us even today. Now, I will say I will say that if you've watched the films, I think both portrayals of the two BBC films that are most commonly watched, the portrayals of Anne Elliot are terrible, terrible. And in those,
I haven't seen them. So
don't, because
I'm completely blaming Miss Austen herself for Anne.
Yeah. So you know, maybe those filmmakers saw that. Saw her as that, or those actresses did, but it's terrible. Like, it's, that's not how I saw Anne Elliot, and I found it very violating to have Sally Hawkins and the other you know, actress play them like spineless wimps, because you know, play Anne Elliot like a spineless wimp, because she's not.
So I wanted to ask you if you find that setting the Jane Austen stories in, at least, this is probably more true of Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, which you actually set in India. Recipe for Persuasion is set in the United States.
No, they're both set in the United States. They are an Indian-American family. It's the story of a politically ambitious Indian-American family. And Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors is set in the San Francisco Bay Area, where the older son is running for California governor. So it's very much set in America.
Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors has got him running for governor.
So the overall arc for these four novels, when I imagined them, was this politically ambitious Indian-American family in the Bay Area, and their oldest son is running for California governor, and the stories kick off with the announcement that he's running, and then they will end when the election results happen.
Right, so that's going to be all four books?
That's all four books, yeah.
I think, and it's been obviously a little while since I read Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, and I think that the flair of India and the feel must have just sort of soaked into me a little too thoroughly. But what I wanted to ask was, do you think that using your Indian heritage and working within that culture, you kind of get the advantage of some of the more strict expectations that Jane Austen's heroines faced? Like, it might be harder for people to buy feeling huge pressure from your family, from some suburban Chicago kid, whereas if you're looking at a tiger mom or at an Indian parent who has expectations about marrying within the Indian, I don't even know what the words are that I'm looking for. Anyway, do you think that sort of helps to heighten the Austen feeling is what I really wanted to ask.
Okay, so I mean, first, Trisha, who is the protagonist of Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, who is a female Mr. Darcy, because that's a flipped, the story is gender flipped. She's a neurosurgeon at Stanford. So you know, very much an American story. But I think you're right, and it isn't that simple, because I think expectations are you know, family expectations are pretty ubiquitous and universal. Having said that, it is, you know, Indian families have peculiarities and lack of boundaries, or at least mine does. And so I have, but I think a lot of families have. I was again having this conversation with someone else who is not Indian, and she said, are there families where they believe in boundaries? And I don't know families that believe in boundaries. So I think it's a more, you know, it's naturally, you know, a part of being a family. But then as an author, always world building, right? So you could. They could be a white family, they could be a Korean family, they could be a black family, as long as I, as an author, can make you believe that that's how their relationships and their bonds are, that's all I really
yes.
need to do. And for me, being, you know, being an Indian girl, being an Indian American girl, naturally, you know, that there is authenticity to my understanding of how Indian families interact. I do feel like it's not that unique, but that just might be because that is my life. So it is easy for me. I don't know if it's easier for the reader to process. But yeah, of course, you know, to write it again, you know, Jane Austen was about family, but I think that it was really more about society. So how rigid the society you lived in was. And again, in these books, it is very much the modern world. So it's not like rules have suddenly appeared. It's that rules exist in our world. They're just more subtle than they were in, you know, 200 years ago.
I just wonder if the rules feel easier for a white reader to stomach because they can sort of be like, oh, yes, Indian families are like that, but, you know, and yet the reason that they're in there and identifying is that all families are like that, exactly like you said. It's an interesting way of just thinking about how readers let things into their minds and where they go with it.
And again, you know, I come across all sorts of readers, right? I come across the reader who will come to me and say, with great amounts of, you know, disbelief that they could actually relate to my characters. Like, they think they're saying something nice to me, and they're like, my gosh, I could totally relate to Millie, who, you know, who was a child bride. And so, you know, and my reaction to that is always, you can relate to vampires. So why are you surprised that you can relate to, you know, an Indian girl?
You can relate to Jane Austen's heroines. Yes. They're as far from us as anything.
Exactly.
It's way farther.
Exactly. And then there are the people
who... That's pretty
funny. And then there are people who will say, you know, who have read one book and it's a check mark. Oh, I read an Indian book and now I know everything about the Indian culture and I'm done with my little woke check mark. And there are readers who inhale all of my books and see them as a story and then, you know, are reading and processing them like they would read and process any story. So I think that there is a good spectrum of readers. And again, I'm essentially writing it as a story. And my hope is that everybody will, in the end, we will be a world where everybody will read it as a story, not an Indian story.
It is very much a story, except for the part where it makes you hungry for Indian food. So I'm sorry. That is your fault. And you know, the worst part is that most of us can't, well, some of us can't get that anymore because we're all cooped up in our houses. So.
Take out.
I don't have any delivery.
You don't. Yeah, there's recipes on YouTube.
Okay.
I just wanted to point out that at the beginning of Pride, Prejudice, and Other Flavors, chapter one actually begins in India with the heroine's childhood, this beautiful, rich memory of her visit to a family estate. And what happens there. And I just love the way that you get this glimpse of her as a young child. And then you snap your fingers and you're in this hospital in Northern California. So I felt like I was being dunked into her sort of mythical past before shown the harsh hospital lighting. And that just helped color it that way for me as a reader, that she was just more interesting than if I had seen her in a lab coat for the first moment.
So I will again, and as writers, all three of us, I'm sure, have had to make this struggle, and that is, you know, the likability of your female protagonist. So just by virtue of writing a female Darcy, and that was one of the reasons, you know, that I wrote this book, and also one of the reasons why writing this book was a very personally transformative experience for me, because I set out to see if arrogance and owning your own power and privilege and your own brilliance and all of that would still be easily palatable. I mean, would be easily palatable in 2019 in a woman as it was in a man 200 years ago, right? In 1813. And so it turns out that it isn't, you know, it turns out that it took a lot of iterations to make Trisha consumable. And it was work because, you know, because a woman being arrogant and a woman being impatient and a woman being lacking in empathy is not seen the same way as a man being all those things. And and one of those things, I think one of the reasons that I had to show you right up front, you know, where she's coming from, it instantly softens her, which is kind of sad that she needed that instant softening. And if I was showing you a man in that same situation, I may not have had to soften him. You know, we would all have been much more accepting of his arrogance, and you know, and trusted that it'll come. You know, he'll come around because men.
He would save the cat eventually.
Because men are expected to be jerks in fiction, and especially romantic fiction when we start out. You know,
that's so true. And you know what? If Pride and Prejudice had begun with little Darcy in knee pants, like snuggling a swarm of puppies, I don't know if I could summon the same outrage during that awful proposal. Right. And I think that we should take a pause right here with Darcy in knee pants with the puppies before we talk about what we've been reading.
Excellent plan. Writers, before we get to what we've been reading, let's talk about what you've been writing, or rather, where you've been writing. Have you got a pile of colored index cards that represent scenes and plot lines and characters and keep getting shuffled around on the floor while your dog walks on them? A notebook full of pages with half an outline here and a list of things that belong in another scene there? I get you. And I want to encourage you to take a look at Dabble, the writing software that works the way our writing minds work, or maybe the way we wish they'd work. Capture all those little details and big plot lines in a system designed to help you keep track of where you are and where you're going. We love Dabble, and we hope you will too. Get a free trial at dabblewriter.com, and please head over to our Facebook group and tell us what you think. So, great. Now it is time. Let's talk about what we've been reading besides, in my case, actually, I'm not sure. I might talk about it, so never mind. But what have we been reading that did not involve Darcy and with a swarm of puppies?
I so now want to read Darcy with a swarm of puppies and you know, and boy shorts or little boy shorts.
That's
not
your
boy
next
shorts.
Quadrigy. What do you call a four book series? Well, that'll be the next one. It'll be like, you know, Darcy and the puppies. No, I'm taking that. Actually, that's probably Serena's idea. She's trademarking it even while we're speaking.
Serena, you do it. I want to read it with someone else having done the work.
All right. So what are we reading? So now
my books are easy.
Okay. Then so you go first, Serena. Well, Sonali and I gather our thoughts about the puppies.
My book club has picked Pale Rider by Laura Spinney, which is a book about the Spanish flu of 1918. And the structure of Pale Rider is frustrating me, so I have turned to The Great Influenza by John Barry to compare the two, and I will let you know.
Okay.
Wow. I can I just say I have so much respect for anyone reading those books right now, like in this moment in time?
Yeah. That would be grounds for dismissal of book club to me, but props to you.
Thanks.
All right, Sonali, I'm going to turn to you because I am looking up a title on Kindle.
Okay, so you know, it seems to be a really good time for rom-coms. You know, just in terms of what's being published, it's like every book is being published as a rom-com. But it's also a really good time for some, you know, fun and romance. So there's one that comes out in July. It is called Boyfriend Material by Alexis Hall, who is one of my favorite romance authors. just...
I cannot wait to get my hands on that book.
I am telling you, I have been saying that this is possibly the best rom-com I have ever read. Like, it's in that realm. It's that good. And, you know, it's just... So it is this fake relationship, but through the whole book... the fake relationship is in quotation marks, like as you're reading it, these big virtual quotation marks, because it is this complete, of a boy who is the son of a fallen rock star. And so he's a paparazzi darling. He's always in the news for the wrong reasons. He's a mess. And, and to regain his reputation at work, he needs a good, solid boyfriend. And so he finds this man who is a human rights lawyer and incredibly straight-laced and all the things. And it is just delightful. It is laugh-out-loud funny. I mean, there were times when I was guffawing like a hyena. Don't drink hot beverages. You will choke and you will, sputter them all over the place. Hilarious, incredibly poignant, just so connected. It's just a gorgeous book. I mean, it will just leave you so happy. And it's one of those books that also makes you look at yourself, you know, that turns a mirror on yourself. So it's all those things. And it's just amazing. So that comes out in at the end of July, I think, Boyfriend Material.
I'm so jealous that you have the arc. Alexis Hall is so talented.
Incredibly. I think he's one of the greatest talents of the romance genre right now. Glitterland is also an absolute masterpiece, I think. This book, I didn't think I would love one more than that, but this is just, it's just delightful. It's all of the, it's everything a British rom-com should be or can be. So for sure that. I have also recently discovered Kennedy Ryan and think that her writing is almost like startlingly beautiful. And she wrote... The Kingmaker, I think that came out in December last year. And it was what she calls a duet. So, a duology or duet. Duet. And Kingmaker is the first. I think the second book is called Rebel King. But it has this giant emotional impact of like old style romance. But all of the subject matter is so current and contemporary. So she kind of juxtaposes those two things so well, where emotionally it's an old style romance, but it's, it with all the regressive parts gone. And it's this, fresh and very contemporary, very socially conscious take. And of course, I'm not a huge fan of, of the whole alpha label, and Max, her protagonist, is as alpha as they come. And so even with a hero who is someone I would run 10 miles from in real life, I just completely bought it. And she makes it she just makes it beautiful.
That sounds really good, and I have just written Boyfriend Material down on my list of books to order, and I'm going to check out Kingmaker. So I did some looking up in my, just because I had an arc, so I'm actually going to leave the arc because the person, it's not going to be out for a little while. So putting that one aside, I have been reading The Proposal by Jasmine Guillory, and I am only partway into it, and I don't usually talk about books until the author sticks to the landing, but I think this one is probably, she's probably going to. And it is really good, and she has a new book coming out this summer too, which is definitely not just on my list. I'm 99% sure I already ordered it. So there was that, and I also read and enjoyed very much Perfect Happiness by Kristen Cusick Lewis. That one's not rom-com. That's definitely women's fiction. It's a woman who is already married, struggling with all kinds of things to do with being already married. And it's pretty fun because she's a happiness expert who is unhappy. So that was clearly the hook. And it was very, very page-turnery. Very, very hard to put down. So it was fun. And that is what we've been reading, because Serena already told us and we immediately dismissed those because we didn't want to read them. But that's okay. If the rest of you do, you go.
That's all right.
Grab them.
You guys had plenty.
I had enough pandemic.
Sonali, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. That went fast and it was so fun. Thank you.
Should we tell people where to find you, Sonali, besides SonaliDev.com? What's your favorite social media? Where should people follow you?
I am on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and I'm fairly active on, more active than I should be on all three. And I do also have a newsletter, which I was really bad with, but I'm now trying to send out once a month. So it's a very low incidence newsletter. But what I do that people might, you know, have fun with is I do a recipe, a recommendation, and a really bad joke, which is which is a bad joke because my family sends me the most terrible jokes on group chat, and I feel like I shouldn't be suffering alone. So there's that, and if you sign up for the newsletter, I have a free recipe booklet that you get, and of course, I'm told over and over again that the books make people hungry, and these are recipes that are related to the books. So you get that.
Nice. I love it.
There you go, KJ.
All right. Yeah, and there I go. I can solve my problem, which is definitely, do not mock it, because it is real. We live in rural New Hampshire, and basically all we get to eat is what I cook, and I need to cook some new things.
Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry. I love to cook, but I think I've had about enough.
Yeah, I too. I love to cook. I love to, and the same has been said of my book, that it makes people hungry. Not that anyone's going to read it for months and months now, but that it makes people hungry, and there are recipes involved. And let's don't even get me started. Yes, I love to cook, but yesterday I just looked at my entire family and said, "Do you know, I have like." I mean, really, it's not just the cooking, but y'all go to bed and every single one of you leaves like one glass or one can. And every night it's me and that one thing from every one of you. And there are a lot of you. And I'm going to bed now and y'all better pick it up before I get up. So.
You're lucky it's just one. I think we're all there. You're lucky it's one. And my family, it's like every single time you're thirsty, you have to take a new glass out. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's that too. I was trying to be generous to them with the one, because while I was saying it, I was like lifting up a can and a glass and this. And people are sort of rushing forward like, well, but I meant to. I was like, yeah, no, you didn't. Oh, well. Oh, well, this was super fun. Yes, I echo Serena in saying thank you for coming. And Serena, do you want to take us out?
Yes, ma'am. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.
Pause. Stop.
Stop.
Thank you.